Charles Dickens' A Life is the acclaimed biography by Claire Tomlin. The first in our series of abridged extracts is read by Penelope Wilton.
January 14, 1840, London. An inquest is being held at Marylebone Workhouse, a muddled complex of buildings between Marylebone Road and Paddington. The beadle has assembled 12 men. Most of them are middle-aged local tradesmen, but one stands out. He is young and slight, smartly dressed and good-looking. He is a new resident, who's just moved into a fine, airy house close to Regent's Park. The new juror is Charles Dickens. They have come to pronounce on a case of a suspected infanticide. A servant girl accused of killing her newborn baby in the kitchen of her employer's house. The young woman, Eliza Burgess, is brought in. She looks weak, ill, and frightened. Her story is that on Sunday, the 5th of January, she went into labour in the kitchen of her employer's house, where she was the only servant. When the front doorbell rang, she hurried upstairs to let in two lady visitors, and by the time she got back to the kitchen, the baby, a boy, had been born under her skirts and appeared to be dead. She found a box in which she placed the dead child and hid him under the dresser. Her mistress, Mrs. Simmons, sent her up to scrub the front doorsteps in the cold, and then, seeing how ill and thin she looked, taxed her with having given birth. At first she denied it, but then confessed and showed Mrs. Simmons where she had put the baby. Mrs. Simmons sent for a hackney coach to remove Eliza and her dead child from her house to the Marylebone Workhouse Infirmary. Mrs. Simmons appears as an unsympathetic witness and resists questions from Dickens. The next witness is the house surgeon, Mr. Boyd, who is not able to say positively whether the baby was born alive or dead. Dickens resolves to take on those who are ready to find her guilty of killing her child, and he argues against them so firmly and forcefully that he wins the argument. The verdict is given: found dead. She falls on her knees to thank the jurors, then she faints and is carried away. She will still have to appear at the Old Bailey, but the threat of the death penalty has now been taken from her. Dickens, who is without doubt the busiest man of the 12, goes home and makes arrangements for her to be sent food and other comforts in prison. He also finds an excellent barrister to defend her at the Old Bailey trial. This is a very small episode in the life of Dickens, but it allows us to see him in action, going to the workhouse just along the road from his own home and deciding to help a young woman who comes from the very bottom of the social heap, a workhouse child, a servant and a victim of ignorance, of gullibility, of an unknown seducer and a harsh employer. He's at his best as a man determined in argument, generous in giving help, following through the case. What makes his behaviour the more remarkable is that he was himself living under intense pressure at this time. He was very successful and also exhausted. He'd spent the past 4 years in the hard labour of writing 3 long novels in monthly instalments, huge efforts of imagination and penmanship that had lifted him from obscurity to fame and comfort. The names of his characters passed into the language: Pickwick, Sam Weller, Fagin, Oliver, Squeers, Smike. The voice of Dickens offering fun and jokes, then switching to pathos with a good peppering of indignation, seemed like the voice of a friend. He felt the strain because his income and standard of living depended on keeping up the pace. He might be in his study from 10 at night until 1 in the morning, or up early at his desk by 8:30. Eating out, going to the theatre, adventuring through the rough areas of London with a friend or two were habitual ways of spending his evening. he was passionately interested in prisons and in asylums, the places where society's rejects are kept. He saw the world more vividly than other people, and reacted to what he saw with laughter, horror, indignation, and sometimes sobs. He stored up his experiences and reactions as raw material to transform and use in his novels, and was so charged with imaginative energy that he rendered 19th century England crackling, full of truth and life. Charles Dickens was born on the 7th of February, 1812, just outside the old town of Portsmouth. His mother, Elizabeth, was 22, his father, 27, and they already had one child, a daughter, Fanny, aged 2. John Dickens was a character. He was the model for his son's most famous character, Micawber. He was expansive by nature, with an easy way with money. He had a steady job in the Navy Pay Office, was likable, plump, and full of fun. And he and Elizabeth made a cheerful couple. When Charles was 5 months old, the family was obliged to move to a smaller house. Here, a third child, Alfred, was born and died at 6 months. That winter, their father was summoned to London. The family found lodgings on the north edge of the city, where in 1816, a fourth Dickens child was born, Letitia. But in December, John Dickens was sent out of town again, this time to Chatham in Kent. Dickens looked back on the years in Chatham as the idyll of his life. He had the blessings of secure family love, ideal landscape, river and town, good teaching at Mr. Giles's classical, mathematical and commercial establishment, and his small world was beginning to expand pleasurably around him. Then they heard that their father was being taken back to London and they would have to leave with him. They began to prepare. Mr. Giles offered to keep Charles until the end of the half and invited him to lodge with his family, and this was agreed to. The 10-year-old boy made his memories of the years in Kent into a treasure trove in his mind. Kent was always a place of delight and pleasure, a paradise of woods and orchards, sea coast, marshes and rivers. The landscape and towns of Kent gave him settings for many of his books. His first novel, The Pickwick Papers, is partly set in Rochester, and his last, The Unfinished Mystery of Edwin Drood, centres on its streets and assigns real houses to its characters. David Copperfield tramps across its bridge on his way to find his aunt. The pattern, structure, and setting of human lives was the stuff of his novels, and he saw the structure and pattern of his own life as closely related to place. Journeys in and out of London made crucial turning points in his novels, for good or ill. And in July 1822, he made just such a crucial journey, age 10, and alone. The Dover to London mail coach, known as the Commodore, arrived close to the Navy Pay Office in Somerset House, where John Dickens worked. It was a summer evening, so father and son are likely to have walked north together to their new home in Camden Town, through streets now observed for the first time by a child eager to learn his surroundings. The streets were crowded, noisy, and dirty. There was smoke in the air and filth on the ground, but also excitement and bustle, carts, horses and pigs, men on horseback, pony traps, carriages, and a great many children, mostly poor, ragged, and barefoot. In Camden Town, the Dickens family fitted tightly into a narrow terraced house. There was a shortage of money, and soon the house was abandoned, along with a pile of unpaid bills, and the family moved down the hill to Gower Street North. They were pursued by creditors with increasing ferocity, their furious knockings and shoutings at the front door driving Charles's father to ignominious hiding places upstairs. Finally, he could hide no more, and he was arrested for debt. John Dickens was taken to the Marshalsea debtors' prison across the river in Southwark. Before he was escorted away, he made a dramatic statement to his son to the effect that the sun was setting on him forever. Whatever he meant to convey, the child was reduced to despair. Yet when his mother sent him to the Marshalsea the next day, he found his father had cheered up. He offered Charles the sound advice Dickens later credited to Mr. Micawber, that with an income of £20 a year, an expenditure of £19, 19 shillings and sixpence meant happiness, but an expenditure of 1 shilling more meant unhappiness. In Gower Street, things got worse. Charles was sent out to a pawnbroker, first with the books he loved, then with items of furniture, until after a few weeks the house was almost empty and the family was camping out in 2 bare rooms in the cold weather. All these experiences of debt, fear, angry creditors, bailiffs, pawnbrokers, prison, living in freezing empty rooms and managing on what can be borrowed or begged, were impressed on his mind. Now James Lammert, a former lodger, came to see Mrs. Dickens. He was currently managing a small business where boot and shoe blacking was manufactured and put into pots to be sold. Seeing the situation of the Dickens family, he suggested that Charles might help out by coming to work there. A light job, covering and labelling the pots of blacking. He was put to work and was soon known to them all as the young gentleman. They were kind to him, but all the same he remembered, "No words can express the secret agony of my soul as I sank into this companionship. My whole nature was penetrated with grief and humiliation." Dickens details the life of the small boy he was with apparently good recall and sureness of touch, and his narrative is as painful as anything in his novels. It immediately links him with the many children who endure suffering in their pages: Oliver, Smike, Nell, Paul, Joe, David, and little Dorrit. At the end of April, William Dickens paid off his brother's outstanding debt of £40, and John was discharged from the Marshalsea. He now remembered that his son needed to be educated, and Charles was sent to Wellington House Academy. The most surprising part of this whole affair is told by Dickens: that neither his father nor his mother ever mentioned the blacking factory or Charles's year as a child labourer again in their lives. Not a word. Not a hint. Charles needed to play after his working year. At school, he was a leading spirit in theatrical performances, and he wrote and circulated stories and got up Our Newspaper with another boy, hiring it out to readers who paid in marbles for the privilege. It is a relief to learn that those of his schoolmates who remembered him described him as a cheerful and mischievous boy, joining in pranks such as keeping bees and mice in their desks, and sometimes, as a joke, pretending to be one of the many poor children of the streets and begging from the old ladies of Camden Town.
Well, you can hear the next instalment from Charles Dickens, A Life by Claire Tomalin, tomorrow. The abridger is Richard Hamilton and the producer is Elizabeth Allard. BBC Radio 4. Now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, Tuesday the 29th of November. There are warnings of gales in all areas except Trafalgar. The general synopsis at 1800. Low, northeast Iceland 959, moving slowly northeastwards, deepening 956 by 1800 Tuesday. New low expected Viking 973 by the same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking north at Cira, southerly 7 to severe gale 9, veering westerly 5 to 7. Later, rain, squally showers later, moderate or good, occasionally poor. South at Cira, southerly 6 to gale 8, perhaps severe gale 9 later, occasional rain, moderate, occasionally poor. 40s, Cromarty, 4th, Tyne, Dogger. South 7 to severe gale 9, veering west 6 to gale 8.